to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. I'm the pastor of Hope OPC in Grays Lake, Illinois, and I'm recording all the way up in Wisconsin. I'm on the other side of the border. A while ago, I was on the other side of the border in Indiana. Now I'm on the other side of the border to the north in Green Lake, Wisconsin. And we're here for a Presbytery conference every year. The Presbytery of the Midwest holds Camp Westminster at the Green Lake Conference Center, and it's a wonderful time for a lot of families, and not just families, but other people to gather together for a week in between basically a Monday and a Thursday night and to discuss matters. We have a speaker this week, David Veldhorst, the Reverend David Veldhorst from Bethel OPC in Oostburg, Wisconsin, speaking on the book of Ecclesiastes. It's been spectacular so far. We're looking to more of that this week. But that means I have some special guests with me from the Presbytery today. I want to introduce to you first a name that many of you would be familiar with from his work with Reformed Classics and some things that we do on Reformed Forum, and that's Bob Tarullo. Bob is the pastor of Westminster OPC. Camp Westminster, Westminster, I mean, it's all related.
I don't think they...
We all have the same standards.
All referencing the same thing, yeah.
He's the pastor of Westminster OPC in Indian Head Park, Illinois, which is at the intersection, roughly not too far from the intersection of I-294 and I-55, correct?
That's right. That's absolutely right, with the crossroads.
The crossroads. There's a lot of cars that go through there.
There are a lot of cars. Very easy access to the church.
Absolutely. Welcome, Bob. It's great to have you. We also have a ruling elder from Westminster OP. We have Rob McKenzie. Rob, you also work with InterVarsity Press, correct?
I do. I'm in sales with InterVarsity.
Yeah. Well, it's great. We always love hearing what's going on, and we always really love when Rob brings remainder books.
Oh, you have to strike that. Nobody ever heard that. I don't know what you're talking about. Moving on.
Yeah, moving on. So thanks, brothers, for coming and for giving us this opportunity to speak with you. We wanted to speak with you, of course, get a little bit of update about the church and your work there, but also one extension of your ministry at Westminster OPC is a new podcast, one that's been going for several months now, called Theology Simply Profound. And I'm very excited about this podcast. I listen as I have opportunity and listen to many episodes. And one wonderful series that you have going on now, a very strong series, is on dispensationalism. So we not only wanted to give the listeners a little bit of a preview into this podcast so that they can go subscribe and listen, but also kind of give them even more motivation to go and say there's a good lengthy, but yet still thorough and ironic treatment of dispensationalism that I've found wonderfully helpful. So that's what we're going to get into today. But before we do that, I've got a few things to mention. Christ the Center, of course, is listener supported, and we encourage you to visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate to pledge your support today. We thank you so much for all the support we've received up to this point. And it helps us to continue our ministry. We also are in great need. We have recently hired a contract editor, someone that works on a contract basis to help with editing of the written materials on the website. That means that we have some further expenses, but we're delighted to hire him. We have Dan Ragusa, a good friend and a faithful worker, very, very sharp mind, and he's been writing as well as editing other writers on the website, and we are expanding our efforts there. Also branching out into the capital R Continental Reformed tradition. We're very thankful for Dan, who is also a member of the URC in training for gospel ministry in the URCNA, United Reformed Churches of North America. We love those brothers dearly. And, you know, one thing we haven't done well in the 9.5 years of Reformed Forum is branch out outside of the Presbyterian bounds into the Reformed community, and that's a great opportunity for us. Dan's helping us to do that. So if you have some Continental Reformed brothers and friends out there, whether they be in the United States or Canada or overseas, wherever they may be, share with them what we're doing here and encourage them to join in with our community and to pitch in. We'd love to reach them and to grow and to hear from them as well. Also, if you're at the website, please visit us at reformedforum.org/conference for information about our conference coming up October 7th through 9th at Grays Lake, Illinois at Hope OPC. We've got our third annual now conference coming up. And we're looking forward to many people coming and participating. We're going to be speaking about the image of God, but we're branching out, connecting that main theme with several other theological themes. Glenn Clary will be up from Pflugerville, Texas. I always like to joke with that. Pflugerville, Texas, a northern suburb of Austin. And he's an expert in Reformed worship. And he teaches a Reformed worship class for the OPC's Ministerial Training Institute. He's done extensive research. He's completed a DMin, and he's continuing to even work and research and labor, looking at more things he can do in Reformed worship. But with that Reformed worship expertise, he's looking to connect the image of God theme to our observance of the second commandment, which tells us we ought not to make images of God. And so this should be a very insightful and wonderful, practical, yet deeply theological session. So that's just one example of some of the sessions that we're going to be offering October 7th through 9th in Grays Lake. Visit us online now and register and get in soon and try to lock in a good rate. We'd love to see you in October. Well, brothers, let's get into speaking a bit about the podcast. But before we do that, could you tell us a bit about Indian Head Park and where you meet and a little history of the congregation? Bob, you were relatively new. You precede me in the presbytery by, I don't know, how long? A year?
Maybe a year.
Less than a year?
I think, yeah. So I
April 2013 for me. So maybe
August 2012.
Okay.
August 1.
Wow.
So
has it been that long?
Yeah, this past Monday.
You just had an anniversary.
I just had an anniversary. That's right, 4 years. And so congregation's been around since 1950.
Mm.
Ed Clowney was one of the founding organizing pastors, you might say, back in the 40s, late 40s. He was in the Wheaton area, and he was establishing the congregation. Mm. And so we've had several pastors throughout the years. And I took the reins, so to speak, in 2012, and have been working for these 4 years. And I've been enjoying the congregation, seeing it mature and grow, as I have as well, and have really enjoyed the opportunity to serve this little congregation, but one that actually, you know, because of the location, because it's on the crossroads, as we already said, between 55 and 294, we get people from north, some close to actually to Grace Lake.
Yeah.
Well, not that far, but
well, we're right off 294. Well, 94 up there, but yeah.
Right. But we have some, you know, far north, mm-hmm. some far south, some far west, and mm-hmm. the because of the highway, people are able to make it in pretty quickly. And there's a great commitment, which I really enjoy with this body, to doing things together. So even though there's those distances by way of travel time and mileage, they're able mm-hmm. to come quickly together to one local spot or central spot for midweek Bible studies and morning and evening mm-hmm. worship. And it's been great. And recently, over the past year, one of our elders really got our youth group going. Mm-hmm. And we do a lot of interaction with our youth group with Hanover Park congregation, with a name that you're familiar with here at Matt Cotta. And so our youth groups get together once a month for their youth group. And mm-hmm. then we also have it normally, you know, every other week as well. And we've had a blast with our youth group.
It's Presbyterianism in action.
Yeah, it's where we're trying. Yeah. I mean, trying to put the connectionalism together in the life of the congregation, or in the life of the congregation, the life of the youth as well, so that they don't just see pastors go off to presbytery or women just go to presbyterial, which is only once a year anyhow.
Yeah.
We get to see
it. It's not a governing court, if anybody's worried. It's just, OPC hasn't changed here. It's a women's event every year that's focused on missions. We call it presbyterial.
That's right.
Women's
that's right,
presbyterial.
Yes. Women's presbyterial. Yeah, you got to make that clear. But it's a good Reformed Presbyterian congregation, you know, young and old. One great thing about our congregation as well is that we've taken up the reins of supporting Gospel Life, which is our mission work, which has been a presbytery mission work for mm-hmm. a long time, but was in need of a session. And so now we have
that's in the loop, in the
that's
Chicago
in the
loop.
South Loop location. Yeah, mm-hmm. Pastor John Rowe,
right near Chinatown.
Right near Chinatown, along the lines. What's it? The Red Line that they're right along. Yeah. So it's easy access as well for those that don't have vehicles or that are downtown, need to mm-hmm. travel there. It's a great congregation of folk that gather in the South Loop area for anyone listening. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of opportunities there. So mm-hmm. there are a lot of good things going on in the Chicagoland area. We're very thankful for your labors, but also delighted to be able to pass on some of this to the listeners, because you never know. People are, certainly, many people are going to have family members or friends that live in the area, but right. Chicago is one of those places people are often driving through on vacation and whatnot. We always love seeing visitors.
Absolutely, so absolutely. Great. And Chicago is just so big. There's people everywhere, and so hopefully, you know, we get the word out that there are these pockets of Reformed Orthodoxy throughout Chicagoland that we just people need to find.
Yeah. Well, and you have to make sure that you mention the most exciting thing about our church, the new current thing. That we're a Pokemon Go stop.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, you can't. Don't leave that out.
Do you have some, like a, what is it, a Pikachu? You have some?
I think it's
right by the church sign, station, though, isn't it?
It is the church sign.
It is the church sign.
Oh, the church sign is the power station.
And actually, in the interior of the church is a gym.
Yeah.
It's a Pokemon gym.
So. Well, on the other churches. So I guess where we worship, the location is at the corner of two major intersections. But we worship at a historic congregational church, which has a chapel, which is where we worship, built in the 1850s. And then in the 60s, they built a much larger section for themselves. And so they rent this out. And so we have that, which gives us access to, you know, classrooms as well as this historic building. So we have this historic building, which is not a Pokemon's Go.
correct, gym. But our church sign is.
The sign is a stop.
Okay.
All right, Rob.
You got to get this
And then the congregational building is a Pokemon Go gym, just so everyone knows. And the cemetery in the back, that's a stop as well.
Other things in the cemetery.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, that's nuts. So, yeah, we've always wondered, and we just heard another pastor talking about how he's trying to figure out how to turn Pokemon Go into some evangelistic tool.
People are actually showing up. Well, there are. I mean, there were people hanging out at our sign, resting after they had to walk to it. There's no sidewalks to it.
Yeah.
And there are, if you look online, there's actually evangelism tools to use with Pokemon Go already. Yeah, it's happened fast.
Wow. Who'd have thought? Well, there's all, you know, whatever way the Lord brings them.
You never know.
They become all things to all men. But,
yeah. Even Pokemon.
Even Pokemon.
Catchers.
Rob suggested I dress up as a Pikachu, but that will not happen.
I mean, not in the pulpit, just in the parking lot.
You might get accosted or come away injured or something. People are going to start throwing lures at you or something.
You'll throw something at me.
So, Rob, previously you were at Orland Park, correct?
I was, yeah, for about 10 years.
Tell us about how your time there and then how you came to Indian Head Park.
Well, I grew up dispensational all the way through college, independent, fundamental, and it was good. We had a good church, good churches I was involved in, good godly people, a lot of good biblical teaching, although, of course, it was dispensational, but still a love for Christ, a love for Scripture, and went through college, went through Bible college, finished my Bible pastoral degree, and my wife also finished at same college and got her elementary education degree in Bible. And just after we were in, right after we were out of college, we, through the study of Scripture, became Reformed. And we had gone away to school in West Virginia, and we stayed there for a few years. And while we were there, the best thing we could find was a Reformed Baptist church, which we had to drive an hour to.
Wow.
One way.
These 1689 typers?
It was, no. Well,
New Hampshire?
No, I wouldn't.
Calvinist.
Calvinist, Reformed, covenantal, not dispensational.
Okay.
More toward the 1689,
I gotcha.
But not subscribing, I guess you could say. great group, learned a lot, really was a good time. But we knew we were always Presbyterian.
Okay.
And every year the pastor would preach his infant baptism sermon, and afterwards he'd come up to us and he'd apologize. He'd be like, I'm so sorry. And I'd say, well, brother, you believe this. Preach the word. This is what you believe. And I just said, but the more you preach on the kingdom, understand that I become more and more convinced of beta baptism.
Wow.
And he would laugh, and that was fine. Of course, now actually he serves at a church where they do beta baptism.
Oh.
So it's interesting how that works out. When we moved back to Chicago, because I grew up in Chicago, we looked for a Reformed church, and we'd already been familiar with the OPC, and so we just looked for OPC churches, and we ended up moving close to Orland Park, and we spent 10 great years there with Ian Wright, and learned a lot, a lot of good friends, a lot of good memories, a lot of good sermons, and really have a special place.
He has a true gift for prayer.
It's incredible. I firmly am convinced that preaching is when given by Scott. It's just it brings you closer to heaven. Yeah,
it's got blood.
Don't tell my pastor.
Unfortunately, I don't think I have any of the visible attributes. So well, they're not in my voice or affect.
Just don't tell my pastor I said that. But it was it was a really excellent time. And Indianhead Park had gone through a series of changes, and they had asked for some help. Yeah. And so several families from Orland Park took up the call and went to Indianhead Park, and we were very. My wife and I were very privileged to go. We had actually moved. We were a lot closer to Indianhead Park at that time. And so we thought it would be a very natural step for us. And they needed the help and went over there and got talked into becoming an elder and dragged kicking and screaming. And here I am. So
the Lord has his way. And it's a great privilege to have you in the presbytery and have all your commitment and faithfulness also as an elder now. Mm-hmm. And I know Bob's greatly appreciative of all your work at Indian Head Park, and the Lord's doing a great thing there. You guys have grown recently, and you're strong, and you're doing well.
It's a good group. Well.
It's a good group. It's a good really folks. Good, committed group that really loves the Word and worship. That's
I know we do pulpit exchanges once in a while, so I'm always encouraged, overly encouraged when I come down and am able to preach to the people. It's been a blessing to me. Good. So I can only take it's that as a hear. Sign that the Lord's working well there. So. Well, Robbie, you know, I had some experience myself in dispensational circles. I grew up, though, in the mainline church in the PCUSA. I guess for the first 3 years of my life, it was the UPCUSA. And then in 83, it merged with the PCUS. I just finished reading another history of Presbyterianism, reading Sean Michael Lucas's history, and it went back to the PCUSA name by which it's known today. And so I grew up in a relatively conservative church, but it wasn't one where I was catechized. As the preacher, through most of my childhood, was the pastor there, who was the pastor through most of my childhood. He was a five-point Calvinist and conservative covenantal and all that. But growing up, you know, I didn't, because I wasn't catechized at home or through the church, I didn't have any explicit awareness of a hermeneutic or, and not saying their young people even need to necessarily know that word, although it's helpful. But I had this kind of stuff in the ether or kind of had a feeling for what sounded right. In terms of, and it was covenantal theology, but I didn't know it or know how to articulate it. So when I ended up in college, I was making friends through Campus Crusade for Christ, and I was coming into contact with a whole host of evangelicals from a wide, wide range of traditions. And that's where I encountered dispensationalism firsthand. And they were telling me all these things about the end times, and I'd never really known about or studied much of the end times. And so it was all new to me, and I thought, I've never heard this. And what I didn't know was I was getting a particular version of a pre-trib, premillennial, dispensational eschatology. That being said, my wife, who was a friend at the time and eventually a girlfriend, long story short, we got
first,
married.
Wait, first wife and then girlfriend?
Yeah.
Is that,
yeah. Okay. And so we began through a course of attending a bunch of different churches, started attending likewise a Calvinistic type Baptist church. They were most of the pastors there were five-point Calvinists. They were folks that came from the Master Seminary out in California, which is John MacArthur's group or the group that he's associated with, the seminary and the college and all. And so most of them were five-point Calvinists, but yet holding on to and maintaining a slightly progressive version of dispensationalism. And so although maybe years and years ago that would have seemed like this very odd hybrid, it's not that uncommon because of Dr. MacArthur's influence. And we were really attracted to this church because of their faithfulness to Scripture. They believed in inerrancy. They preached from the Bible. They interpreted the Bible, not in a pedantic way, you know, but yet we were all had our Bibles open during the sermon. We were learning the Word of God, and we heard the gospel. But after being in that church for a little while, we went to that one of a church plant from that church, a very faithful church, Living Hope Community Church down in Bartonville, Illinois, which is just south of Peoria, where we were living through college and just afterwards. And so we loved it. A very faithful church and everything. But over the years, I came to hear more and more about a dispensationalist interpretation of Scripture and a view of ecclesiology and the people of God. And I didn't know why, but it just didn't sound right to me. And it wasn't until many years later that I had been studying and starting to learn Reformed theology, reading, you know, catechizing myself, and started finally to have the explicit categories for kind of what I had implicitly from my youth. And that was my introduction to dispensationalism. But I gather that a lot of people that might be in Reformed churches today, I don't want to say a majority, I don't know what the number breakdown are, perhaps you can give me a clue, but there probably are many people in Reformed churches that have only heard of dispensationalism as a thing out there that don't have any
if they've even experience. Heard the word.
Really?
Yeah, I've, a lot of people. I was really shocked. Coming from dispensationalism to Reformed theology, because I was studying and the scriptures opened up as mm-hmm. I became more Reformed, and I just thought, well, this is great. Here it is, the historic interpretation of Scripture, the historic doctrine. Mm-hmm. This is fantastic. And I just assumed everybody in the conservative Reformed world not only understood most of covenant theology, but they were also aware of dispensationalism.
All the different approaches.
I just assumed that. Mm-hmm. And come to find out, as the more I'm in Reformed circles, mm-hmm. that there's a lot of parallels of the people of God in both distinct forms of systematic theology, wow. where there's that kind of ignorance. Mm-hmm. And in dispensationalism, the misunderstandings of covenant theology usually stem from fear. Mm. So because of that, that's kind of why you'll hear them say, well, you believe in replacement theology. They want to all of a sudden throw out a pejorative and say, well, your doctrine is nothing but allegorical, and you don't take the Bible seriously.
Right.
And that's a fear. Those are fear comments. Mm-hmm. And in the Reformed world, it's often, what's dispensationalism? And I've had many Reformed people over the years just come to me and they say, yeah, my brother-in-law's, he was telling me this thing about how the church is different than Israel. Uh-huh. And I'd say, oh, it's dispensationalism. And they'd say, What's that? And yeah. I was really surprised. So there seemed to be an ignorance within the Reformed world that I was it just surprised me. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously not in the academy. In the academy, you know,
well, even there, still might have an appearance of knowledge,
sure.
but not much actual depth to that. Bob, you didn't grow up in a Christian home, correct?
I grew up in a mainline Episcopal home.
But you came to faith much
came
later
to faith
in life?
Through the Episcopal Church, but 17 years old, yeah,
okay.
is when I first came to know Christ as a Savior.
Yeah,
you know?
Praise God.
Yeah, absolutely. Through a priest in the Episcopal uh-huh. Church and such. So, yeah, it was wonderful. But my only reference to dispensationalism was through the pulpit of a Reformed church and through the membership class that I took coming into the Reformed church or the OPC. I think it was, there's a little booklet and a series of booklets. It was like by, I think it was Calvin Cummings. And there was a short little section of that on and this isn't Confessing Christ. It's another one that he wrote.
Oh, I see.
And it was had a snippet on dispensationalism. And it was all very negative and spoke of it in terms of teaching two ways of salvation and Schofield as the primary source. And that was my primary first understanding of what dispensationalism was.
I see.
And it was, and from that point on, even it was always from a Reformed point of view and more of a bookish, you know, not experiencing mm-hmm. people within dispensationalism only from, you know, a stance, which sometimes can be more of a caricature at times.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it could be right at times, but other times off. And so then when I got in the pastorate, you start coming across and I said, well, this is what dispensationalism. And they're like, no, we're dispensationalists. This isn't what we believe. Mm. So wait a minute, what's going on here?
Yeah.
And then you have to try to, and then you meet up with other pastors in a local ministerium and they're dispensationalists because they're from Master's Seminary. And you're like, wait a minute, we're praying the same stuff here.
Yeah.
You know, how are we fellowshipping when you teach two different ways of salvation as I understood it? So there's, right?
Right.
So there's a lot of confusion that can come about unless you are willing to sort of take the time. And that's what Theology Simply Profound has been doing, I think,
yes,
with Rob having the experience of growing up within it and trying to make a good assessment and then becoming within the Reform community and sort of saying, hey, why are we misunderstanding each other on these points? Yes, we have disagreements, big disagreements, mm-hmm. but let's make sure that we understand those properly even. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what Rob's trying to help us with.
Yeah, Rob, I was wondering, we're certainly going to, we plan to include some material in a segment at the end of this recording, so you can get a little bit of a preview into one of the most downloaded episodes of Theology Simply Profound, so that you can whet your appetite and go download the other ones. Certainly, there's a wealth of information. How many episodes have you done now, recorded now?
We've done 10.
Have 10.
We recorded 11? We've recorded 11. 11th comes out on Friday.
In the ballpark of roughly 40 to minutes to an hour each.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of material there, and it's good. And Rob, you're writing a book currently,
yes,
right, on the subject.
Yeah, that's where really this came from, or the idea for the podcast, mm-hmm, came from. I'm writing a book. It's called Replacing Our Misunderstandings, mm-hmm, the title. And I've had lots of subtitles. We'll see which one I go with. I love subtitles. You know, it's all the reading the Puritans makes me have to have long titles. There's a lot more in the book than there is in the podcast, because obviously I have time to really,
sure,
parse things out. But one of the fun things for me, writing the book, because of my experience, has been many conversations with dispensationalists, trying to explain to them, mostly my friends and family, and occasionally their friends who they want to argue with me, which is fine. I've had mostly good conversations with, mm-hmm, people, and just trying to explain Reformed theology to them and seeing, helping them see past their own misunderstandings. With the Reformed group, I've had more people in the church coming to me saying, hey, my friend said this to me. And so I've had 5 or 10 minutes and just explained to them why the dispensationalist believes that. And they've, you know, people will come and say, well, they said Jesus isn't a king. How could they say Jesus isn't a king? It's like, well, that's because for them, Jesus isn't reigning now. He will reign in the millennial kingdom. Yeah. So then when they understand where they're coming from, uh-huh, it's oh, okay, I guess I understand that, but I don't understand why they come to that.
Right.
But one of the fun things for me actually has been stating what dispensationalists believe and watching Bob's reaction, which I didn't really anticipate when we started the series.
You got to record that with a GoPro or something and put just the camera on Bob on YouTube, because I'd watch that.
I try to explain it. I try to for those who can't see that.
Bob's reaction, that could be the name of the channel.
It would have been good. We could have done stills. Oh, that would have been fun.
So we certainly, we hope everyone will go listen to all the episodes, and I trust a good number will. Yet for those who are listening right now, who have only heard now us speak about dispensationalism, and perhaps may or may not have some sort of vague understanding, what are some of the high points? Are you able to provide just kind of a real thumbnail sketch about the basic beliefs of dispensationalism then and now, you know, classic versus progressive?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, dispensationalism, for a basic understanding, is the belief that God has divided history, for lack of a better term, because there's some argument within dispensationalism about using that term, but really history.
You're becoming a scholar, Rob. Yeah. You got to qualify everything you say.
I do that a lot. But there's basically 7 dispensations in, uh-huh, history, starting from creation till the end of the millennial kingdom. And God there's 3 things within a dispensation. You have a people, mm-hmm, and you have a test, and then you have a judgment if that test is broken. And at the end of each dispensation, man fails the test. And then there's judgment. And then at some point, it doesn't have to be concurrent, but at some point after that, a new dispensation will start. And the same thing, you have a people and you have a test, and then you will have failure and a judgment. And that goes on all the way through to the end of the millennial kingdom, when finally everyone that will be saved is already saved, and there's final judgment, new heavens and new earth. What it ends up doing in one of the dispensations, in the dispensation of grace, is the people of God were Israel, and God has given a covenant to Abraham that he will fulfill within the nation of Israel. And when Christ comes, he offers them the kingdom. Here it is. Here's the fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant. I'm offering it to you right now. And this will also be the fulfillment of the Davidic covenant. Christ David's son will reign on the throne. So here it is. I'm offering it to you. And the people of Israel rejected it. So Christ says, well, all right, obviously I'm adding this as far as parsing it out. I'm paraphrasing a little bit. Christ says, all right, you've rejected it. My work with you is over for right now. We're going to put it on pause. And what's often called a parenthesis within dispensationalism, they'll call it a parenthesis. You'll even hear them call it Plan B.
They will.
That is in their literature. I think because of criticism against that, you won't hear them call that now. But that is something they've had within their system. They'll call it Plan B. And Christ deals with a new people called the church. So they are completely distinct, Israel and the church. They have two different programs. There's a new dispensation that started. This dispensation of grace, is only for the church. It's not for Israel. At the end of the dispensation of grace, you have a rapture. And that is the pulling out of all the church, both living and dead. Mm-hmm. They are brought to heaven for 7 years. But when they're brought to heaven, the tribulation period will begin. When that begins, God is once again picking up his program with Israel. He's now saying, okay, you blew it before. Here's your next chance. And this time, God is going to make sure that the people get it.
And these are the 144,000 of the book of Revelation.
Well, roughly speaking, fit in. Yeah, the 144,000 are the two witnesses that will be present during the dispensation at the beginning for the first 3.5 years. And that's either Moses and Elijah or Elijah and Enoch. There are disagreements.
Because they didn't die.
They didn't die, right? And they will raise up through their witnessing 144,000 Jewish male virgins who will then preach. And through them, there will be lots more that actually come to Christ through their ministry in the last 3,500 years, or 3.5 years. And then the second coming, and then they enter into the millennial kingdom. Mm-hmm. And that is the fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant. It's the old covenant is gone, the new covenant is there, and that is the Abrahamic covenant. And that's what I believe is the key sticking point between the two systems.
And when is the mostly in the classic, in the version of pre-trib, pre-millennial dispensationalist eschatology that you hear, that literal 1,000-year millennial period, which happens after the tribulation, then Christ comes back, temple's rebuilt.
Yes.
You know, where it was, on Mount Zion.
Yes.
Christ reigns in the flesh on that temple. But then
On
David's throne, there are glorified bodies. So you and I who have trusted in Christ, people who are part of the church that have believed on Jesus, return with Christ in the clouds with glorified bodies.
Yes.
While there are also members of Israel still in non-glorified bodies until the end of this 1,000-year period. Is that correct?
Yes, yeah. That is correct.
Or until they die during the 1,000 years, maybe.
If they die. Yeah, some might live the whole 1,000 years.
Yeah.
That's possible. I mean,
because an dispensationalism, infant who dies at 100
will be considered young.
Yes.
Yes, that's right. Well, you had mentioned the different renditions of dispensationalism. Okay. And dispensationalism seems to have morphed every 50 years. Mm. So it began in 1830 under John Nelson Darby. And he was part of the Brethren movement, but he was the catalyst. He's the one who developed the dispensational system. And through his teaching in England, he started to develop some followers. But it was really in America that he actually had his most influence. In the Presbyterian Church, actually. In St. Louis was the main church with Pastor Brooks. And in the 1880s, you had Pastor Brooks discipling C.I. Schofield. And his influence would end up changing some of what Darby had taught. It becomes much more where it had a lot of Calvinistic and Arminian influence at the start. I've been told that Darby himself was a Calvinist. That might be true. I actually haven't seen evidence for nor against, so I'm fine either way if he was or wasn't. I just don't know.
What we do know is he is not Dabney.
No, he's not Dabney.
Who was a Calvinist.
The Southern Presbyterian, yes. To other, our Southern Presbyterian friends, I'm not talking about Dabney.
R.L. Dabney.
R.L. Dabney, yeah. But in the 1880s, 1890s, you had C.I. Schofield that started to become the greatest teacher within dispensationalism post Darby, and I'm going to say,
Dabney
now. Okay. So the culmination of his teaching was found in the Schofield Reference Bible.
Which really proliferated it.
That's what really did it. You had the Nagar prophecy conferences in the 1880s, 1890s, and even the early 1900s. Mm-hmm. And those prophecy conferences kind of set the tone for what dispensationalism would be. But you have many differences within Scofield dispensationalism than you would have about 50 years later with one of his greatest students, Charles Ryrie. So Ryrie comes along in the 1940s, 1950s, that becomes prominent, along with Dwight Pentecost and Walvoord and Whitcomb and some of these dispensational mm-hmm. names. And I think Dwight Pentecost, actually, I believe, is in that era, is probably the best scholar that dispensationalists mm-hmm. have.
He used to come around years ago to Peoria, and there really? Was a PCA church. I can't say it was PCA at the time. I don't know for certain.
Okay.
But Grace PCA in Peoria, Illinois, to my knowledge, mm-hmm. was pastored by a man named Bruce Dunn. And he okay. was a well-known dispensationalist and used to really? Host these prophecy conferences. And guys like there Pentecost would come by to this Presbyterian
Isn't
church.
That incredible? It's always... I shake my head on stuff like that. I just don't understand that. But, I mean, yes, there's a brothers in Christ, and we should love them and you know, go to Starbucks with them. But
yeah. And Brian Chappell's a pastor of that church now.
Oh, that's where he's a pastor.
Times have changed.
The times have changed. But what you had with Scofield, you know, you had Scofield in the 1909 edition of his reference Bible. You do have him saying that the Israelites were saved by the keeping of the law. So through that is where people today now understand dispensationalists to believe that you can be saved apart from Christ, or that each dispensation teaches a different way of salvation. And Ryrie, when he came along, by then actually the teaching, some of Scofield's teachings had become defunct. And within dispensationalism, people were not teaching that because of the challenges of people like A.T. Alice Ritterboss also was a big agent to try to set them straight. But Ryrie would come and he would teach where, you know, that is not the case. We're all saved by Christ and Christ alone. And even Scofield in some of his other books would say that everyone is always saved by Christ and only through Christ and Christ alone. And we are not saved by our works.
Right.
But still, dispensationalists have to deal with the fact that that was in their most popular teaching. Mm-hmm. And Ryrie again would dispel that. And so what would become what we would know as the main body of dispensationalists, the most popular version, is Ryrie dispensationalism. And with C.S. Scofield, and this started with Darby as well, we talked about the Israel and the church difference, where Israel is God's earthly people and they will be on the new earth for eternity. The church is God's heavenly people. They will be in heaven for eternity. And that's what C.S. Scofield taught. Ryrie, when he at first did teach that, but as he developed his theology, he kind of changed that. And now with progressive dispensationalism, no, there's no way they don't teach that at all.
Right.
We all enter the millennial kingdom. We are one people, still under the nation of Israel during the millennial kingdom, but we go into eternity as one people of God. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we have Ezekiel's temple that for Scofield, Ryrie, yes, this is Ezekiel's temple. It is in the millennial kingdom. The feasts are reinstituted. Sacrificial system is reinstituted. Sin offerings are given. But progressive dispensationalists say, no, there's no literal temple. Mm. So it's definitely a good change. You know, again, where you had Ryrie teaching in the 40s, 50s, and him developing his theology that had changed from the 1880s, 90s from Scofield, which changed from Darby. It was 50 years after Ryrie in the 1980s that you had progressive dispensationalists come along. So it's just interesting how it
there's a lot of contours and a lot of movement, and it's helpful to know that we don't just have one cookie cutter, you know, doctrinal system here. It's helpful to be informed and to understand the shifts in the movements and the different positions that are within the dispensationalist camp. And that's something that you can learn about as you track through all the different episodes on Theology Simply Profound.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. We take the time.
Yeah,
to really go through it.
How many more episodes do you guys have planned, roughly? Any idea?
Two more.
We have 11 on this series.
And then we will go on to other things. Yeah.
And where can people find you online, the podcast?
Well, the podcast you can find at the church's website, so www.westminsteropc.org. Mm-hmm. We also have a Facebook page, Theology Simply Profound, a mm-hmm. Twitter at TheologySP.
Yeah.
So those places are places you can, we can be found. Also on iTunes, of course.
Yeah.
No reviews yet. So, hey, come on.
That helps out a lot.
Get on out there. Yeah. Get us a review.
I encourage people too, to review the Reform Forum and the Crisis Center post, because that actually helps. And one of the ways that they... they changed the ratings in iTunes, or not the ratings, the rankings.
Rankings.
Is highly dependent on reviews. So review Theology Simply Profound. Review us as well. It'll help us out.
What we ask is that you write a great review, give us 5 stars, and then you listen.
Yeah, at least.
Be fantastic. At least download. Download. You know, just really review 5 stars, download, and then if you have time, listen.
If you have time to listen.
Yeah, we appreciate that.
No, I can attest to the fact that there's so much helpful information here, and it's a joy to listen to. So I appreciate both of you brothers taking the time to join us today, but also to have recorded 11 episodes and to have a plan for the future. And we're looking forward to your book. Any you still fishing around for maybe some publisher ideas? You kind of exploring some options? You don't have to get show your hand if you don't want to.
No, I had a publisher who was very interested and made it to the final stage, and then I got on the cutting floor. And being in publishing, I understand that.
Sure.
It took a lot to get to that stage. No, I don't.
I've had issues.
It was actually a great... it was. I was happy for the experience.
Yeah.
And again, being in publishing, I know how hard it is to get to where I got to be the final stage.
Yeah.
I have a couple other publishers right now that
don't give
have
up.
Shown interest. Yeah. So we'll see what happens.
Okay. Praise the Lord. Well, we look forward to hearing more. We look forward to reading more. Check it out online, westminsteropc.org, and I'll be including an episode selection here after this. But I do want to thank everybody for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.
Welcome to Theology Simply Profound, a podcast of Westminster Orthodox Presbyterian Church, where God powerfully speaks through His means of grace. This is episode 27. Thank you for joining us today on Theology Simply Profound. My name is Bob Turillo, pastor here at Westminster Presbyterian Church. We're located at the corner of Wolf and Joliet Roads in Indian Head Park, Illinois, and we're serving the western suburbs of Chicago. With me today is Rob McKenzie. He's an MA student at Reformed Theological Seminary Global and serves as a ruling elder here at Westminster OPC. Rob, it's good to be with you once again today to discuss dispensational theology once again. This is part 5 of our series on dispensationalism, and up for today, we are talking about the dispensation that's called the Dispensation of Promise. Dispensation of Promise.
Yes, yes, it is. And it also can be called the Dispensation of Patriarchs. You'll hear that as well.
The Dispensation of Patriarchs.
But usually it's Dispensation of Promise. That's normally what you hear.
Well, Rob, is good to have you back with us on this particular subject of dispensational theology, discussing the dispensation of promise or the dispensation of the patriarchs, as you said. But let's get right into it.
Okay.
And just get off the bat, what is the dispensation of promise, or as you said, the dispensation of patriarchs?
Although you won't hear that as much, but I wanted to throw that out there. Because if people hear that, then they'll know what other people are talking about.
Right. It'd be like an eighth one if, we didn't know that they were the same.
Oh, no. Don't get me going on the different – because there's a 3 version, a 5 version, a 9 version.
Okay. What version are we working
with? We're working with the 7.
The 7.
Which is the main one. It is a good number.
That's
the
main one.
The number of perfection there. Well, of course, and that's what most dispensationalists would know and adhere to would be the 7 dispensations. And those who hold the different dispensations are not actually – necessarily trying to disagree, and it's more just this is just how we're gonna plan it out. It's becoming a little more common. I think people in theology always want to come up with things that are new, just to stand apart. But anyway, the 7 is the norm. The dispensation of promise, though, so human governments ended. Mm-hmm. It ended with the Tower of Babel. That was the judgment. The people under that dispensation were to allow human government to mandate the godly laws that are in our hearts, that are on our conscience, since the dispensation of conscience had failed. And the people were supposed to disperse. They were supposed to fill the earth, multiply. But they did not. They stayed in one area. They built a giant tower and tried to create their own religion. So God in his judgment confused their languages and then scattered them, which is one of the results of the languages being confused. People, different groups moved off to different areas. So even in judgment, God is fulfilling his commands.
So that ends... That ends the dispensation of human government.
Yes.
Okay.
And so now we have some time that passes. We don't know how long, but there is some time that passes. And then God determines that he will start a new dispensation. And by doing that, he calls a man named Abram. Of course, we know him as Abraham from Ur, which is in Babylon, which is interesting because he calls him from the place of judgment. He calls him out of judgment. To send him to the promised land. But in this dispensation, we have three promises that are made, which is hence the name, dispensation of promise. One is that Abraham's name would be great. God would create from Abram a new and great nation, and God would give them a land that God was going to bring Abram to. And so Abram... was going to be given this land and his descendants, and that's how the people are structured there.
Okay, so essentially we have judgment that comes, end of Genesis 11. We have an unspecified period of time until Genesis 12. I mean, obviously in the Bible it's really quick, but
right.
But and then you mentioned the point of the place of judgment, meaning that he's called out of the land of Ur. Or the place of the Chaldeans, right?
Right.
Which is what we know to be Babylon.
Right.
And that's why you referred to it as the place of judgment, sort of the scattered area. And then we have one man called out of Ur to go to be a part of God's promises.
Right. Well, there's a change that's happening here. Mm-hmm. And let me quote Ryrie, because Ryrie notes this change.
Okay.
The governmental feature of the economy is best emphasized by the designation, all mankind had been directly related to God's governing principles. Now God marked out one family, one nation, and in them made a representative test of all. So basically what Ryrie is saying is that God had been working with everyone, the whole world. Now, whether that was Adam and Eve, two people, or all the people that were involved eventually in the Tower of Babel, still working with every person on the earth. Now God is pulling out one family or one person, really.
Okay. So he's choosing one particular man now to deal with. That's essentially the nature of it.
Yes.
Okay. And gives one man this. But then he uses this language of, in the quote you said, representative test of all. What that sounds a lot like covenantal language.
Yeah.
So what would – in dispensational theology, what would that – what would that representative test of all? What's the nature of that, as best as you understand it?
Well, you have to remember that dispensations have tests. They have blessings and curses. But within that, there's the rules that are set up. It is the stewardship of your household. A dispensation is how we're going to rule our house at this time. And the tests that are given to Abram is to leave the land. Leave the lander and go to the land that God would show him.
Okay.
And of course, Abram is representing. He is the representative of his family and then eventually the nation of Israel. So when God says, I will give this to you and your descendants, he's also giving him a test. You have to leave. And that's going to recapitulate itself within his generations. So staying within the land is going to become the main rule to follow within the dispensation. That's what they have to keep.
Okay. They have to keep the land.
They have to keep in remaining in the land.
Okay. They have to keep themselves
right
to remain in the land by being, following God's, rules.
Right. They're to be faithful and dwell in the land that God would give them. God called Abram. He was faithful. He left the land. Although it's interesting because depending on who you're listening to or reading, the fact that Terah, his father, goes with him and Lot, depending on who you're reading, that can be a problem. Either okay. that can be Abram was actually not faithful, even in his departure, because he brought his father and Lot with him. We will see that God dealing with Abram in this way because Terah dies. Mm-hmm. And Lot would be a thorn in his side, and they would eventually have to separate. So, you know, was bringing Lot wrong? Was mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, we are told, there is a lot of fighting that goes on, but we're also told that Lot was a righteous man. So, mm-hmm. but you'll hear that in within the dispensationalism that Abram right away kind of shows his lack of true commitment until Terah dies. And then once Lot is separated, that's kind of the true, now he's all in.
Okay.
Kind of thing. But, you know, he was faithful. And Abram's descendants were to continue. Ryrie goes on, actually. Let me find this here. Okay, this is from Dispensationalism Today. The responsibility of the patriarchs was simply to believe and serve God. And God gave them every material and spiritual provision to encourage them to do this. The promised land was theirs, and blessing was theirs, as long as they remained in the land. So that's Ryrie.
That's Ryrie. So as long as they remained in the land, I mean, sorry, this sounds almost silly question. So if they stepped outside the land? All right.
No, it's not like that. No, okay. It's not like a jail cell. Okay. It's not. I mean, there's no.
They crossed the boundary.
Can't cross this line. Well, no, they are to remain living in the land. That doesn't mean that they can't go, you know, on holiday.
I'm sorry. I don't.
No, it's okay. No, but, it's a fair question.
The language it's a fair just question. Suggests
it does sound like
things.
That. No, and I know you don't. It's a fair question.
Okay.
But yeah, no, they could. They could leave, you know, mm-hmm. go on vacation, go to Egypt to shop, things okay. like that. You know, even spend a couple weeks there.
So pull out the rules, right? We've learned so far in that there's rules for each dispensation.
Right.
What are the rules for Abraham?
Well, it's to go. It's
okay,
to go
so
to
he
the
goes,
land.
Right.
And then it's to dwell in that land. We know that Abram dwells in that land as a nomad. He actually doesn't own any of the land until he buys a tomb. Mm-hmm. And that's really all he ever owns. So the dwelling, I mean, God was saying, I'm going to give you this land. So the faith is the emphasis. You always have to come back to that. Faith is the emphasis here. Abram goes out in faith from Ur to a land that he'd never seen, you know, that, and he uproots his whole family, and he dwells as a nomad. He never actually is given the land that God promises to give him, except that God says, I will give this to you and your descendants. And that's really where the promise is fulfilled mm-hmm. in the giving it to his descendants. So God makes these specific promises. If the people believe God, and this is Abram, his family, his descendants, then God's going to remain faithful. So this is the rules. That's what you're asking about. You know, the rules are go, remain in the land, you'll receive the blessings. These are long-term blessings. But just like the other dispensations, the people needed to be faithful. Just, you know, Adam and Eve had to be faithful in the garden, not eat the tree. Of course they did. There had to be obedience to the conscience, mm-hmm. And the people were not, and human government failed as well. So, you know, that's we're seeing this okay. pattern develop.
So in these patterns, one thing that I've noticed as we were talking about this, it sounds a lot like what we would describe as the covenant of works. In the sense that if you disobey, you are thrown out or something like that.
Yeah, there's some similarity
okay.
there.
Obey and live.
Obey and live. Well, yeah. No, I you'd ask me on a different podcast about we had been talking about Calvinism and Arminianism, mm-hmm. and I had said that really I don't see how dispensationalists can be Calvinists, and it's because in the dispensations, except for the first one, so you have Adam and Eve in the garden, they are righteous, they can choose right and wrong, they have and they choose wrong. Now,
because of total depravity. How can God set them up with dispensations where they have rules that they have to keep?
Right. Setting them up for failure.
Right. You know, okay, I'm going to give you here's the rules for you to obey, even though you are totally depraved. Mm-hmm. And that's why I don't see how Calvinism can really fit in dispensationalism. However, a lot of Calvinists who are dispensationalists make it work. But I think they're missing that. I think they're actually missing the fact that within dispensationalism, the one of the core elements is that the people have to be able to pass the test. So when God says to the people for human government, you have to be able to set up a human government that can and does carry out actions that uphold the moral truth of God. Mm-hmm. And same thing in the conscience, the people have to be able, in order for dispensationalism to actually be able to do what it's setting out to do, setting up a people to obey God, following those rules, they have to be able to do it. And once somebody is totally depraved, they can't.
Right. After the fall, these things are – they're incapable in and of themselves. I mean, which brings us back to Abraham, because you said that the emphasis here is on faith.
Right.
Okay. Well, what faith? What's the kind of faith that Abraham would be required to have here?
The faith to go to a place he's never seen.
Okay.
And the faith that God is giving it to him. I mean, again, he never is given the land himself, mm-hmm. but it is for his descendants. And that's contained within the dispensation. It's contained in the passage. One thing that is always emphasized, and of course, in Reformed theology, we emphasize this as well, that here's Abram, you know, in an idol worshiping area. I mean, mm-hmm. everybody's worshiping idols. Yeah. Abram himself is being called out of this.
Right. Out of worshiping so many different gods and now monotheism all the way.
So that in and of itself is faith mm-hmm. coming, and dispensationalists would definitely bring that out, that aspect out.
Okay. And then essentially, I mean, would you say that it's very similar to covenant theology then? We also focus a great deal on Abraham being the exemplar of faith.
Well, I mean, yes, in that respect, they would have a high respect for Abraham's faith as we would.
Okay.
Definitely.
Okay. Well, how does all this relate to the Abrahamic covenant that we see throughout the pages of Genesis?
Well, it relates in the fact that the Abrahamic covenant, which is made, you know, soon after the dispensation mm-hmm. Starts, but the dispensation that must be kept, we have to keep it separate. You got to remember that the dispensation is running on a separate course than the covenant does. Same person, obviously, in the way they can overlap, you know, they have things to do with each other, but don't. The covenant, what am I trying to say? The covenant is not absorbing the dispensation.
We can't confuse the two.
Right, which it almost sounds like it does. That's why I'm laboring at this. But it doesn't. With the covenant, of course, we see the recapitulation of the same promises from the dispensation are in the Abrahamic covenant. But what the covenant does is it removes the need for obedience of the people within the covenantal framework. Now, in the dispensational framework, we have the conditions placed on the people, but we don't find those conditions within the covenant.
Well, how does that work itself out then? If one doesn't, do the people have to follow the dispensational rules or the covenantal rules or both? Does that work?
It would be both.
It'd be both. But in one, there's no requirement for obedience, just faith, and the other, there is a requirement for obedience. So how does that work?
Well, you know, the key aspect actually is we got to look at the purpose of dispensations.
Okay.
The failure of the people of the dispensation, you know, these are the stewards of the household. Well, it demonstrates that no matter what God does, no matter what he tries to do, however he deals with mankind, mankind will always disobey. This proves that they, the people, are in need of something outside of themselves for salvation. So the dispensation, well, it demonstrates that even with great blessings and a godly righteous man as the head of the people, that they'll still fail in the end. But by placing the dispensation alongside the covenant, or by giving the covenant kind of as a bonus. Mm-hmm. By doing that, then God himself is saying that he will be the one that fulfills it. He will be the one that hears the promises. You're going to fail. So but because of my grace and mercy, I'm going to make sure that I'm going to bring you to salvation.
Okay. So in this schema, we have a covenant of Abraham, which in covenant theology is a covenant of grace.
Right.
And you have a dispensation, which really sounds a lot like the covenant of works as we would understand it in this sense that, right, the covenant of works is ongoing. All people fall under the weight
right.
of it. As we said earlier, total depravity, right? Condemnation of fallen people, covenant of works. And then God provides covenant of grace. That I mean, sounds very similar. React.
Well, no, it does. You're right. It definitely sounds the same. I mean, there's a lot of the same structure within it. The difference is that, you know, God is making these dispensations with different peoples. Adam, you know, I think, were you saying, I don't know if it was on or off air about mm-hmm. Abraham, it was on Abraham being the new Adam.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It very much sounds like Adam is serving like a new Adam.
Yeah, that Abraham would be like that. Well, yeah, it does sound like that. It's not.
Except he's fallen. Right?
He's fallen, yeah. Right. Yeah, that's the thing. And what he does, here's a big difference. It's not as if Abraham keeps the dispensation, that then his descendants would be given the blessings. Mm-hmm. Abraham, even if he kept it 100% fully, which we'll see in a minute, he didn't. His descendants, even if he had kept it fully, his descendants could still break it, eventually losing it. So in that respect, it's not like the covenant of works because right. we have a representative within mm-hmm. the covenant of works. But I do definitely see the parallel that you're pulling out. And I think Reformed people would, I could see them being a bit confused.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's primarily in the sense of the disobedience would require a loss, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas grace, which is how we typically understand this episode, this covenant, this structure, which is hard to distinguish between dispensation and covenant in my head.
It's a good reason for that.
It's, you know, this is you're in a period governed by grace where God comes in and makes these wonderful statements that he is the one who will fulfill it, right? Throughout
right.
Genesis 12 and Genesis 15, right. that the way that this is going to, from, you know, to your seed is going to be because of my activity,
yeah.
my actions and my events in history. And so what I'm trying to get a handle on is the exact nature of the difference between a dispensation and a covenant and how they interact with each other in relationship to what I already understand,
sure.
which gets confusing a little bit. And I probably the same for our listeners.
Well, this is part of the reason why there is progressive dispensationalism now mm-hmm. is because of this kind of confusion. Mm-hmm. The dispensation of promise, which sounds like it's, you know, the heartbeat of dispensationalism, just the way it sounds, but it's really not. It's mm-hmm. actually very quickly lost, and you know, really, it's the Abraham covenant that becomes the centerpiece. And so, once this dispensation is over, mm-hmm. eventually a new dispensation will start hundreds right. of years later.
Yeah.
And God will keep his dispensation program going, but it does become the Abrahamic covenant that becomes what's really important. And that's what we're going to see fulfilled mm-hmm. Within the millennial kingdom.
Okay. So you said that the Abrahamic covenant does become very important in
oh, yeah.
dispensational theology?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Even though it gets skipped over relatively quickly? Is that what you said?
Well, the dispensational promise is what ends up ending quickly.
Okay. But the covenant itself is something that has
it
implications
dominates.
Far beyond. Okay.
Yeah, it dominates. So that is actually something that dispensationalists and covenant reform people can focus in on. And what we're going to get to in the next few weeks is going to be the heart of where our differences lie.
Mm-hmm.
And how was the Abrahamic covenant fulfilled? That becomes the crux of where we divide.
Okay. Now, let me just back up just one sec. You said how the Abrahamic covenant is fulfilled. Is there in any sense ways in which dispensations are fulfilled?
No.
Okay.
Dispensations always end in human failure.
They always end in failure.
The people will always not keep the rules of the dispensation.
Okay.
So in the end, the last dispensation, the millennial kingdom, dispensation of kingdom, that will end in a failure. And our eternity, or the eternal blessing, new heavens, new earth, is actually the end result of the fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant.
Okay. So covenant then does have a great, or Abrahamic covenant has a great deal to do with dispensationalism overall.
But,
then.
But remember, and we're getting way ahead of ourselves, but the Abrahamic covenant is fulfilled in the millennial kingdom within Israel, not for all the people of God.
Mm-hmm.
Now, progressive dispensationalists would say that would agree with that statement, but would also say that all the people of God become one people of God and for eternity are one people of God.
Okay. So, but like you said, we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Way ahead of ourselves.
All right. So we have this covenant, or I'm sorry, we have this dispensation of promise. What happens to it?
Okay. I mean, yeah.
No, go ahead. What happens to it? I'm sometimes just mumbling.
Do you need a break? Do you need some water or something? Okay. Okay. So the dispensation, now remember I said it gets broken. And it's broken by the disobedience of the patriarchs and their descendants. Abraham fails. He fails by going to Egypt during the time of famine. Remember, he's supposed to stay in the land and rely on God. Now, it's not that he couldn't leave. I mean, he needs food. He's going to Egypt. But he goes to Egypt and lies about his relationship with Sarah. And that's, that's a big thing. Now, if he had just gone to Egypt for food, that really wouldn't, but he's not, see, that's his lack of faith. Remember, it's centered around faith. And we would agree with that. Mm-hmm. He's wrong in doing that, and that's a lack of faith. But the really big failure for Abraham was that when he had a son with Hagar. So he's given the promise, you will have a son with Sarah, and he's ends up having a son with Ishmael.
Okay.
So that's his main failure, or his failures. Isaac fails when he also goes up to Egypt and lies about his wife. Again, it's the lying. It's more the lying than it is anything else in that respect.
Hold on a sec. Let me just back up here. So we're talking about what happens to the dispensation. Yeah. So Abraham lies. Abraham has a son with Hagar.
Yeah.
We have Ishmael. But
the main failure.
Yeah. But there's still... But there's still something happening with Abraham.
Well, the dispensation isn't broken yet because although we in a dispensation, the people are to keep the rules, but God is a merciful God. And at some point, you can break them enough that you received the curses.
Okay. So it's not like strict justice.
Right. Then. And see, that's that's why you have to be careful about trying to look at it as a covenant of works. Because one sin broke the covenant of works.
Right.
So Isaac, did the same thing as Abraham did. But that's not his main failure. His main failure is he didn't listen to God, that the younger was supposed to rule over the older. So Jacob was supposed to be the one who received the blessing, but Isaac wanted to give the blessing to Esau. So that was Isaac's main failure.
Okay.
That he didn't have faith enough to believe God. Jacob, of course, has many failures and, leaves the land, without any idea of return. He was going to go. He decided to come back, but 20 years later?
Mm-hmm.
So that's his main failure during his life until Joseph, although we'll get to Joseph in a minute. Okay, so sons of Jacob have many examples of unfaithfulness and sin. The most egregious is, of course, selling their brother into slavery to Egypt. Joseph, he is the most faithful of this group. But some actually dispensationalists, he'll be criticized because he brought his family to Egypt. you know, and yeah, I know. Well, hold on.
You can't see this, but my eyes are kind of like, yeah. Huh?
Well, and I, you know, I only bring that up because okay. I've read and heard dispensationalists that criticize Joseph for that.
Okay.
But then you have other dispensationalists that would say, okay, it was a famine, no problem, come to Egypt. But as soon as the famine was over, they should have gone back because they're not to dwell. That's the thing. They ended up leaving the promised land and dwelling in Egypt. That's the failure.
That's the failure in dispensationalism here. Okay.
Yeah. So then they don't go back. And that's the final straw. And we know that that's the final straw. We know that the dispensational promise is broken and over because of the judgment that comes. And that is, of course, them becoming slaves. They're slaves in Egypt. That's the judgment of God. Dispensation is over.
Okay. Hmm. That ends the dispensation of promise.
Yes.
So that doesn't end, though, the Abrahamic covenant.
No.
Okay. Now, just for my own sense of continuity, does that mean that the Abrahamic covenant is ongoing?
Yes.
It does not stop?
Correct.
Okay.
So when Moses comes, as we'll talk about in a couple of weeks, Moses comes, you have two things happening. He is hearkening back to the Abrahamic covenant. You know, so mm-hmm. when he doesn't come in and say, because of the dispensation of promise, you should come back to the land. No, because that's done. It's basically, this is the God of your fathers, yeah. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Mm-hmm. So he goes back to the covenantal language. But then a new dispensation is going to start at that time. Dispensational law. Mm-hmm. But it's still the Abrahamic covenant that is going to come through it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you say the dispensation of promise has come to an end. We know that through the people going into slavery. But there's those three promises that we started the program with that are in the dispensation of promise that you say get recapitulated into the Abrahamic covenant.
Yeah.
So how can dispensationalists say that dispensation of promise is over then?
Yeah. Well, maybe recapitulation might be a bad term on my part.
Okay.
Because it's not really that. It's just it's the same promises given in the dispensation are also given in the covenant. Okay. So, but again, I want to make sure that we keep them separate because they are separate because the dispensation fails, the covenant eventually will be fulfilled. But you know that, I mean, cause you know, dispensation and covenants are very different. They can't overlap. They can't have continuity with each other. Of course, when we're talking about, the people that are contained within them, they might have a dispensation and a covenant and they're still working side by side. They're both from God. But if God had made the dispensation promise with Abraham and then made the covenant with Abraham, but the promises from the dispensation were not in the covenant, then we couldn't say anything about the dispensational promises. We couldn't say, oh, those are going to be fulfilled. But only because they've been placed into the covenant can we say, you know, does it sound like, oh, the dispensation is being fulfilled? No, the dispensation's over. That ended. Because again, theoretically with dispensations, according to dispensationalism, is that if the people of the dispensation faithfully keep the rules, then they will be given the blessings. And that's why this has led Reformed people to, I think, wrongly say, just from hearing that, oh, you're teaching different ways of salvation. But as we've seen in Schofield, and to a degree in Schaeffer himself, mm-hmm. they talk about the other dispensations as if you are obtaining salvation. I mean, Schofield pretty much says that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I understand why it's a fair charge to make against dispensationalism from an academic standpoint of mm-hmm. this has been taught in your system. That's true. But it's not true that most dispensationalists believe that or really have ever believed that.
Okay.
The Reform need to understand that, you know, it's not the dispensation of promise that's being fulfilled in the Millennial Kingdom. Remember, it's the Abrahamic covenant. And although the fulfillment ends or it finds itself functioning with a new dispensation of kingdom, it's still, even within the kingdom, when you find it later, or when you see the Abrahamic covenant talked about in the dispensational law or the dispensation of grace, if they're talking about the Abrahamic covenant, we still have to keep it separate. Mm-hmm. Which again, this is how dispensationalism has been, and up through the 80s, this is what was pretty much taught, although it was starting to change then.
With
progressive dispensationalism. They see, that's where you start seeing the problems. Saucy in the 70s really kind of started to see the problems. Mm-hmm. And when you get to the late 80s with like Craig Blomberg and other people, they're starting to say, wait a minute, there's much more continuity going on between the covenants and the dispensations. We're seeing much more. They're still separate. Mm-hmm. They're still separate. But whereas before progressive dispensationalism, you did not find dispensationalists saying that you're going to see any kind of Abrahamic covenantal fulfillment within the New Testament or now. But with progressive dispensationalism, they would actually understand some sort of now and not yet, this age and age to come. They still see much more discontinuity than the Reformed do, but they are very willing to say, yes, the age to come is breaking into now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we get that with George Ladd, right? I mean, he does that a lot.
But again, George Ladd was a historic premillennialist, but he was not a progressive dispensationalist.
He wasn't. Okay.
No, but progressive historical premillennialism, mm-hmm, still working on the same kind of, you know, errors, maybe a too harsh a word, but still in the same mindset, you know, mm-hmm, of looking for a future kingdom that's yet to come.
Right.
But, and that's why you see with Ladd so much, why he can use the two-age model, mm-hmm, and actually incorporate it right into his whole schematic, because he's Reformed, mm-hmm, and he has that covenantal framework, and he sees the continuity from Genesis to Revelation, God, one plan, the covenant of grace overlapping everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, I mean, even as you're talking about the dispensations and the differences between Abrahamic covenant and the dispensation of promise, and you say that the Abrahamic covenant does not end and it continues, I mean, the first thing that pops in my head is, oh, it continues. It overarches all of this stuff.
Yes,
and it doesn't it therefore connect it all? But that's where I think we would have our differences, which is something that we'll be talking about maybe on our next episode, right? The Abrahamic covenant itself from the Reformed perspective.
Yes, yes. I think that's best that we actually lay out what are we as Reformed theologians saying? What does Reformed theology teach when it comes to the Abrahamic covenant? It's going to help us in our understanding of dispensationalism when 2 weeks from now, when we talk about we're going to talk about the Mosaic covenant along with, of course, the dispensation of law, but we're also going to talk about the mystical new covenant, the covenant, the Palestinian covenant.
Okay.
That is a dispensational thing.
So we're going to talk about three things in one episode?
We're going to maybe. We'll
get ready for a three-hour episode.
Well, I will, I wanted actually to attach part of that to this episode, but I realized it was going to be way too long. So I said, no, that can't happen. We'll see what we get to. But that's why, one other reason why I wanted to pull out the covenant, the way the Reformed look at the Abrahamic covenant, because it becomes very important. And how we interpret that and find fulfillment, and how dispensationalism finds fulfillment, that is that's ground zero, mm-hmm, to the problem that we have with each other. And so I think that's why I want to take more time.
Take a little bit
really
of time
to discover that. Because the Mosaic covenant in and of itself is not necessarily the problem. It's the Abrahamic. How's that? That's becomes the problem.
Okay. All right. Well, that's our show for today. Once again, thank you for joining us today on this episode of Theology Simply Profound. If you want to interact with us about this show or one of our other episodes, feel free to find us on Facebook or Twitter at TheologySP. We'd love to hear from you. Or better yet, if you're in the Chicagoland area, feel free to stop in and visit us for worship, 9:30 in the morning or 5 o'clock at night. And visit our website at www.westminsteropc.org for more details. Rob, again, thanks so much for sharing your insights about dispensational theology, helping us along understanding the dispensation of promise and the Abrahamic covenant according to dispensational theology.
It's been great. It's my pleasure.
All right. Next time on Theology Simply Profound, we'll discuss the Abrahamic covenant. as we understand it in the Reformed community.